Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
This is Discovery from the BBC. I'm Jamal Khalili, and today I'm talking to one of the world's leading researchers about their life scientific. I'm determined to prove botany isn't the Cinderella of science. That's what my guest today, Professor Kathy Willis, Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Garden in Kew, told The Independent in 2014. In the 2 years since she took on this job, she's been faced with a reduction in government funding. So Kathy Willis has been rethinking the science that's to be done by the staff of the gardens and has been criticised for her decisions. But as well as leading this transformation, Kathy has a distinguished academic career in biodiversity. She's currently a professor at Oxford University, and during her research career, she studied plants and their environments all over the world. She's interested in understanding how places have changed over the long term. Kathy says that you can't decide what to preserve unless you understand the history of the area. Kathy Willis, welcome to the Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Now, given the world's economic, political, even environmental problems and concerns, do you think that the issue of biodiversity is being taken seriously enough?
I think probably not right now. I think what's happening still is that we tend to think of protected areas, and that's where biodiversity sort of is carrying on. And outside of there is, in effect, the Wild West. Anybody can go in there, they can extract the resources from the land, and biodiversity very much takes the back seat. But only 12% of the Earth's surface is protected, or terrestrial surface, and I think less than 1% of the oceans. So it's that 88%. Now, the really interesting thing, of course, anybody who looks on Google Images will see that that area outside protected areas is often the corridor. It's often the area where we have the greatest biodiversity. And what we need to do as conservation biologists is demonstrate the importance of that biodiversity for human well-being. Because I think once people understand how it is useful, that's when they start to be able to understand why we have to preserve it.
Was your early passion for the natural world something that was perhaps a surprise to your family?
Yes, a complete surprise. My enthusiasm for plants came from my mother, who was evacuated during the war. And my mother always used to talk about cornflowers and the beauty of the landscape. And so that really got me going. And then at school, I very much enjoyed doing things like biology, chemistry, geography, but in particular the outdoors parts of it, the understanding the environment. So when it came to then, you know, careers advice, with that mixture, I was told quite firmly that my option, or the thing I should go for, would be a farmer, which to me was extraordinary, given that I grew up in London. No one in our family had ever worked on a farm. And so I then applied for an environmental sciences degree because that had that mixture.
And
that's how
geography and biology.
And that's how I ended up at Southampton.
And it was when you were at Southampton, I gather, that you were first introduced to field work in the New Forest, which is obviously just a few miles away.
Yeah, so all of our environmental sciences field work, even from the first year onwards, we'd go out for Wednesday afternoon, we'd go into the New Forest and we'd be digging around and we'd be measuring stream flow and we'd be looking at microorganisms in the soil. But one of the techniques I became really interested in was taking sedimentary cores from the peat bogs in the New Forest and reconstructing the change in the forest through time by looking at the pollen, the fossil pollen contained in those sedimentary sequences, back to the late glacial, so sort of 10,000 years to present. And there was always an inspiring lecturer, a man, Keith Barber, who just enthused, and we go out for hours on end and walk the highways and byways of the New Forest, and he'd talk about the trees and we'd collect cores and then we'd take them back to the lab and we'd extract the pollen. I just realised that to me was such an important technique to understand dynamics of vegetation through time, that that's when I decided I'd go on and do a PhD in that area.
I hadn't, I guess, really thought about it, but this idea, it's like getting ice cores
in
the Antarctic. You know, the deeper you go, the further back in time.
Yes.
But here you're doing it with peat bogs.
That's right. So you can do it with peat bogs and lake sediments are the other ones. So any anaerobic conditions without oxygen, then you find that the plant macrofossils, fossil charcoal and pollen will be preserved up to millions of years. I mean, the stuff in the New Forest was from the last ice age to present, but I haven't...
So that's tens of thousands.
But I have worked on cores that are 3 million years old from Hungary, for example. And you know, you're looking at this pollen And you realise, actually, in Hungary, you're looking at subtropical pollen, because the whole of Central Europe was covered with this sort of subtropical forest during the tertiary about 3 million years ago. And I find it extraordinary to realise that that was the landscape at that time. So you have this window through the past by looking at the fossil plants, and very quickly you get your eye in to start to identify this different pollen. And as you count the pollen that you extract from set levels, you radiocarbon or date that sediment, and then you have a measure of the vegetation change through time.
Well, Cathy Willis, you then moved to Cambridge to do your PhD. Now, I gather when you finished your PhD, your parents thought you should go out and get a proper job.
Yes. Yes, they did. I mean, I think my father is still quite bemused by what I do, and what my sister's also an academic, so I think he's still quite shocked that we both went in a pathway that he had not much idea.
And you're earning a decent living.
That's right. So when I finished my PhD, I went to work for Cambridge University Press for a year because I thought, well, let's go into plant sciences publishing. And I accepted this job without really having any idea what I was doing. I'll be quite honest. I hate to think what the editor thought of me at the time. Maybe I should ask him actually one day. And I suddenly went from working outside in the field to this office-based job where I arrived and there were like five big piles of manuscripts on the desk. I commissioned all sorts of funny books, one on fish biology, if I remember rightly, which, of course, I knew absolutely nothing about whatsoever.
It's only funny because you're a botanist.
I'm sure I ought to go back and look at that one. But also, what they did have there, which I realised the absolute value of places like these university publishing houses, they published the floras, and I could see the value of these university publishing houses where they're not automatically driven by cost. They know the print run will be small, yet the academic achievement from those floras and the academic use of them long term is huge. It's almost immeasurable, actually.
But that job at Cambridge University Press didn't last.
You were
drawn back to academia.
So I did it for a year, and I thought I ought to give it a year because it's I thought it was really bad form to turn up and then say after a week, terribly sorry, I don't like this, I'm off. So we used to have at Cambridge University Press, that used to have Nature Science and a couple of other journals went around every week. And one week I just had enough, so I decided to apply for everything at the back of Nature that week, which included I was interviewed as a venture capitalist for a job to be a venture capitalist, to work for Lloyd's of London, and also a research fellowship at Selwyn College in Cambridge, which I got. And I think when I got back into that, then I applied for other fellowships and I stayed on in Cambridge for another 8 years. And it was fabulous.
Well, you eventually moved to Oxford University in 1999. And about a decade later, you were made a professor of biodiversity and also associate director of a new interdisciplinary research institute. Why was it important for this institute to be set up in Oxford?
So I was sort of setting that institute up at the same time that the whole idea about ecosystem services and the importance of biodiversity for providing these services that are important to human well-being. So people often give you pollination services is a really good example. So what do you need to do? What do you need to conserve on a landscape in order to ensure that you have good pollination services for the adjacent agricultural fields? And it could be a small copse, and that would be important for foraging habitats, but how far away should it be? So then you need to know, how far does a bee fly? And actually they have a limited distance, about 2 kilometres. So you need to have your copse of good foraging habitat less than 2 kilometres away from the edge of your field. So it's understanding all those interactions and how they work together. That's what biodiversity is really about. And so therefore, within the university, you'd got people in computing sciences, people in geography, people in zoology, people in plant sciences. And the role of the Biodiversity Institute was to pull that together so that you could start to address these really big questions.
And for you, I guess, if you're looking for these biodiversity hotspots, the most famous of all on Earth is probably the Galapagos Islands.
Yes.
And you went there to do some detective work on what had happened to the vegetation there.
That's right. And it comes back to what is the question you're trying to address as a conservation biologist. And in some areas, it'll be that you want to just have a biodiverse ecosystem. But other areas, you have a very clear conservation goal. And the Galapagos, the conservation goal is to restore the environments in the Galapagos to the pre-human baseline conditions. You've got very, very few giant tortoises now in the Galapagos, and they're all in a reserve. But if you look at equivalent islands in the Indian Ocean, you've got thousands, in some of them, thousands of giant tortoises. And they have this thing called tortoise turf. I've never seen it before, which is effectively you've got a grazed landscape. Those are the large grazers on the landscape. And one of the things the first whalers did when they went to the Galapagos, they collected the giant tortoises and took them away on their ships because, rather unfortunately for the giant tortoises, if you turn them upside down, they can't move, and you've got a mobile meat source. Mm. And these things apparently survive for, you know, 3-4 weeks. Sounds terrible, but anyway. And so they decimated the giant tortoise population. So one of the questions they're asking is, well, what impact did that have on the landscape? And what we showed very clearly from this work was, in fact, that the tortoises, they were grazing. You had much more of an open landscape, and you didn't have bracken on those landscapes, and also you didn't have sphagnum peat bogs that are now there. And nice. If you take the tortoises off, you get a large increase in burning, and burning totally changed the vegetation. So therefore, if you want to restore to your pre-human baseline conditions, you need to bring back the tortoises in large numbers, and you would lose your peat bogs, and you'd lose this upland bracken. But there's always a twist in this, because the peat bogs and the upland bracken environments are now highly protected environments because they're full of plants that are thought to be, you know, valuable and endemic, etc., etc. So it all comes back to, where do you put your baseline for what you want to conserve and restore?
Where do you want to... How far do you want to rewind the clock?
Absolutely. Do you go back to totally pre-human conditions? And if you do, is that the environment you think you want to restore?
I also gather that it was while you were in the Galapagos that you had some incident involving frigate birds.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
OK, so I'm actually terrified of birds. Now, it's not rational. I know it's a bit like people being scared of spiders. I just don't like birds. I don't like their wings, I don't like their legs, and I really don't understand
their feet. I looked it up. It's ornithophobia.
I have no idea. And it's a bit of a joke with my family, because if a robin comes and sits next to me when I'm gardening, I scream and run indoors, which is just crazy. But anyway, when we're coring one of these lakes or peat bogs in the Galapagos, these frigate birds started to dive bomb us. And it was the most terrifying, because they're huge and black, like your worst nightmare if you don't like birds. And I had to go and hide. I just couldn't stay there. I just, much to the amusement of my colleagues, but I really don't like birds at all.
Even before the frigate dive bombing?
Yes, no,
incident.
I've never liked them. I won't walk through a group of pigeons.
Okay, back to conservation. Is this understanding of how we need to preserve certain areas getting through? Is the message getting through to policymakers? I'd imagine there's this inevitable clash between ecology and economics. Do enough politicians, policymakers, understand biological principles?
Well, they are. Increasingly it's come through, and it's not the biologists that have actually been winning this sort of trying to get this point across. It has been the economists, people like Dieter Helm in particular, where there's a natural capital committee now for the government. So the whole of the UK has now been mapped out according to what is the natural capital of the different landscapes in the UK. And so therefore the sort of zonation of the land is now starting to occur in many, many regions in the UK according to, you know, what important biodiversity is on this landscape, and how does that feed into, you know, agricultural productivity in that area because of the presence of pollinators, for example. Or, you know, actually many industries are now getting this. So quite a few of the water bottling industries, you know, they know that they need clean water further down in a river basin, but it's heavily reliant upon the farmers further up that drainage basin not cutting their trees down, because then you get a large amount of soil coming to your river and ruining your water. So therefore you start to have a partnership between your industry that requires the biodiversity and the person who owns the land that the biodiversity is on. And it's that, I think that is for us, for everybody, that's the greatest hope for biodiversity going forwards.
These days, you've been involved in developing ways of finding out about an area without even leaving your office.
Yes.
This project called...
It's getting old, I think.
well, it's called LEFT, stands for Local Ecological Footprinting Tools.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So this was a project that happened. It came about from one of these ones where it just happened one afternoon. A former student of mine came to see me and said, I'm working for a consultancy and I've been ill, and can you help me? I need to find a tool where beyond protected areas, you can say which parts of the land are most important to conserve. And I said, I'll do it. I said, it won't take me half an afternoon. I'll just do it quickly for you. And I started looking and realised that at that time, all of the tools are very heavily focused on protected areas and how you partition land in protected areas. But the minute you got outside of protected areas, it was literally being viewed as the Wild West. And yet many extractive industries and companies, particularly oil companies, you know, they have a footprint that is quite small in relative to the area that they're granted the concession to put their footprint in. And so I agreed to go and meet with some of these oil mining engineers, which was one of the most terrifying meetings I've ever had, because I left my nice ivory tower and went out to Stavanger at that point and was faced by these 10 very gruff oil mining engineers, very nice people, but very matter of fact. And I was ready to give this nice talk about flowery biodiversity. And this man said, oh, you know, we've got much time. He said, the question we want to know is, where can we damage? I thought, whoa, you know, that's maybe not, I'm not the right place here. But actually, they were right. That's a really good question, because they said, you know, we're given a 50-kilometre area to as a concession. It's given to us, it's completely above board, but our footprint will be half a kilometre. So what we need to know quickly is, where should we put our footprint, and where, if we put it, will do the greatest damage to biodiversity and carry a huge reputational risk if we have a spillage. So a really good question. So then I started to work with different people to start to say, what are the global databases that are out there? What's the finest spatial resolution we can get this tool down to? Because the other point they said is, most of the tools give us a 25-kilometre grid square. So the output comes back and it's these great huge areas. And they said our footprint is much smaller than that. So we've got this tool now down to a 30-metre resolution, and almost anywhere in the world you can do sort of draw around your area on Google Earth, and it'll come up with a measure of your richness, your threatened species, your resilience of the landscape, your connectivity, the really important features. And it comes out, so you have these different maps that come out. But the interesting thing, when we first did it, I had a postdoc doing this, and it took 13 months to do 4 areas, because taking data off these databases, you think, oh, there's a database that, you know, is fantastic. It's got 380 million species occurrences on it. But actually, it takes ages to download your one area. And so then we had to automate it. And at that point, I then had to start working with computer sciences in Oxford. And we now it now comes out in 5 minutes. So you can really quickly get an assessment of your biodiversity or your important ecological features across a landscape. And then that's used in the assessment of where to put your footprint.
So what sort of areas has this tool now been used?
Well, all over the world. South America in particular. It's mainly the areas that you're going to have the main extractive industries, but also some of the larger agricultural companies are now using this as well. Again, because they're trying to work out where to put their crop across a landscape. And there was one example where I worked with a particular company where they were looking in Turkey. And of course, in Turkey, it's one of, you know, you've got some really biodiverse areas. And it was very interesting because they wanted to test how good the tool was. So they sent their environmental consultant out for 3 weeks and they calculated how much it was. And we did our assessment in, you know, 30 minutes and we met. And it was quite satisfying, but also, I mean, it was a very good-natured meeting, but we picked up sort of 7 more things than the consultant had found out spending 3 weeks in the field. So it's not to replace the field part, but actually there are some areas in the world you're not, you know, for example, you try to go and work in certain parts of the Middle East right now, you just can't do it. And yet you know that there will be people looking for oil there. People want to know which is the part of the landscape you don't want to have to damage. And so therefore you would use this remote approach.
And I guess in general, your research work must sometimes conflict with NGOs and charities, you know, who will have different aims.
Oh, gosh,
to you.
Yes. So one of the problems, I think, is, and it's always the problem, everyone's always working at a massive rush and they're always driven by budgets. But quite often, very basic ecological concepts are used to manage landscapes, which might not be most appropriate for the landscape. So ones that I've come across where I've worked, you know, with an NGO, a big conservation one, where they, you know, I said, oh, well, what are you doing on this landscape? They said, well, we're burning it. And I said, well, why are you burning it? And they said, well, because burning is important for disturbance, and disturbance, we want to have more biodiverse landscape, therefore we're creating a burning regime. And I said, well, have you looked at what the natural burning regime is on this landscape? And they said, no, it used to be burnt, and that's how we know, you know, that we haven't got time to do that. And so I went back and looked at what was the natural burning regime, because the landscape they wanted to create was an important landscape, an open landscape for birds. It had never been burnt before. The reason it was open was because it'd been managed by 2 or 3 generations back. It'd been scythed for hay, but it had never been burnt. So because you're making assumptions about the process that's responsible for the landscape, you can make some really bad mistakes there.
Well, a couple of years ago, Cathy Willis, you joined Kew Gardens as their first director of science. What attracted you to this job? I mean, it's very much in the public eye when you could have carried on your quiet academic life in Oxford.
Yes.
which you still do, partly.
Yes, many a time. No, I mean, Kew is just an absolutely extraordinary place. Anybody that's worked in any aspect of plant sciences. It's a global asset. The collections there are extraordinary. They have 80% of the world's flowering plants in their collections there. And I was interested in the director of science job there because effectively it's the first time they've had a director of science. They split the director's job because it's become so huge as an organisation that in fact they decided that they'd have a director, an overall director who would manage the day-to-day running of Kew and the administration, the finances, and then they'd partition off the science. And so to me that seemed like a really attractive place to go and work.
So given this huge responsibility, I guess, and remit, I mean, was that the big challenge that you faced, just working out what research should be done?
Yes.
You can't do everything.
Yes.
So, and what to stop?
You know, I'd run the Biodiversity Institute. I'd set that up. I'd run that. But that was 50 people. And suddenly you're faced with 250. And I thought, crikey, let's go back to my sort of basic scientific principles, working out what everyone does. So I thought, OK, let's just ask everybody to send me 5 keywords. And I thought, well, I'll get back about 50 keywords. I got 638 keywords back, which to me indicated how broad the science had become across Kew. But when you put it into, when you start to work out which of the main words, of course, the words that you think about Kew, conservation, taxonomy, food security, all of those words came through. So it's honing that back in again. And so that was one of my first roles, and to start to formulate a strategy that meant that Kew could use those fantastic collections to address global challenges, but also to build the collections further, to make sure that we were collecting the stuff that was unique to Kew and we're not duplicating. And then the third thing, to disseminate that science to a much, much wider audience so people do start to understand what we do.
But you did get a lot of criticism from some of the scientists there. How did you cope with that?
First of all, I mean, when I arrived there, I mean, the first week it was announced that actually there were going to be some cuts, as many government bodies had and still are having. And so that was one of the first things I had to deal with, was working out, well, I'm going to have to restructure. And originally, I knew when I looked at the science, I knew I'd have to restructure because it had become focused. The science had become a little bit focused around the buildings rather than about around the area. So I created 6 new departments which reflected what Kew science did: identification, naming, collections, biodiversity informatics, conservation science, natural capital and plant health. So these, and then comparative plant and fungal biology. So you've got these 6 departments. So I set off, I appointed heads of those departments, and then we had to take the budget that we were given and work out what were the positions we could have in each of those departments. And of course, nobody likes to be restructured. So how did I deal with it? Well, I mean, I've always used this very much on my own scientific basis. If someone gives me an evidence base and they can justify what they're doing from an evidence base, then they win the argument. So the evidence base was there. I showed people exactly what we were doing, why we were doing it, and how we'd costed it, and made everything as transparent as possible. But you also have to have fairly thick skin. And once you've set a pathway, you have to hold on to it. I am quite tenacious. You have to be, I think. And now it's changed. It was a rocky 6 months, but I wasn't going anywhere. And I was going to make sure that at the end of the day, the collections and the fantastic scientists there were as protected as was humanely possible.
So will the public see more of the science from
Yes.
Kew?
So that's one of the things. And in the strategy, the last part of the strategy is, OK, how do we make it outward facing so people understand what we're doing? So, for example, we're going to have an annual State of the World's Plant Report. The first one will come out next March. And so it's a horizon scanning, bringing in Kew work as well, because we have a state of the world's birds, but we don't have a state of the world's plants. What are the emerging plant threats in terms of disease? Where are the most biodiverse areas? Which areas are being protected? Which areas are good? Which areas are bad? All of that sort of information will be in there. I'm setting up, and the first one will be next summer, is a children's science festival, which will take place in Kew Gardens in August, again, to very much bring the plant sciences out into the gardens. And then the third thing we're going to be setting up is a plant of the month trail, where you'll go and see the plant flowering in the garden, let's say camellia, and then you'll go and see it in the economic botany collection. So what did the Victorians collect it for? And then you'll go into the herbarium and see the herbarium sheets to do with camellia, and then you'll go to the Jodrell laboratory and you'll have a lecture about the DNA and all the molecular aspects of that plant and why it's important. And we're going to do that every month, different plant each month, so people can see behind the scenes, see our collections and understand the linkages between the different collections and how they give you this coherent whole about what's going on at Kew.
And given, as you've mentioned, this inevitable squeeze on all publicly funded organisations, will you have enough money to achieve all your plans?
Yes, we have to. We just have to. And I think one of the things that we have to be much more realistic about is, what do we work on? What is it that Kew does that's unique? which are the parts that we can say actually that's being done better by the universities or other botanical institutes the world over? And that's one of the questions I'm always looking at. But no, going forwards, I think that Kew has huge potential. But also we need to be partnering more with industries, with universities, with other academic bodies to ensure that we do have funding going forwards. But I think the picture is very rosy for Kew.
This is a really big question. What do you think is the future in general for biodiversity? I mean, how do we balance the needs for development with a growing global population and maintaining biodiversity?
Yeah. So I think it comes back to viewing biodiversity in two ways. I think we're never, given the pressures on land for urbanisation and food and fuel, we're never going to get beyond about 15% protected areas. So we could view those on one side, and that's where some biodiversity will remain. Elsewhere, the biodiversity that we have to maintain is the biodiversity that we identify as being important for us and for the human well-being. And I think that's the only way, realistically. And some people might think, well, that's really gloomy because everything goes into an anthropogenic framework. But I think that's also being pragmatic. So, you know, we've got our fantastic nature reserves. We've got many in the UK. We've got many the world over. And we should maintain, enhance and celebrate those and work out what's the way to keep the processes going. But it's the other part that we need to be thinking about in terms of what is the value of biodiversity.
And, of course, we are now halfway through the United Nations decade on biodiversity.
Yes.
Do you think this is making an impact?
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. I think the problem with all of these decades on biodiversity and these great long targets is most of the targets, they're just not achievable. I mean, there's one target that's, you know, we will create resilient ecosystems by 2020. What does that mean? So I think, unfortunately, they get under the sort of the pen of multiple people in these great sessions, and you end up with these targets that really you have no hope of achieving. And so when people miss the targets, everyone throws their hands up in horror and goes, oh, you know, why are we bothering? So I think really it's being much more pragmatic and on a much smaller scale. If everybody made an effort to try and conserve the bits of biodiversity they see as important, I think we'd have a much greater hope for biodiversity as a whole.
Cathy Willis, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.